Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 80th episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Got a very special guest today, but I just first have to say, I am so thankful to have made it to episode 80. It's kind of an arbitrary point to reach and reflect, but over the last year, this show has grown so much. I've met so many interesting people, learned a ton, and just had an absolute blast sharing these interviews with you listeners. And this is another one I'm excited to share. Jason Hartman is a real estate mogul, podcasting maniac. He has his own network of podcasts, written books, has developed all sorts of amazing real estate projects, and I've learned a lot over the last couple months from watching some of his videos. Got him on the podcast to ask him a little bit about his journey, but also the advice that he has to share with everyone out there who is looking to potentially build their own small real estate empire. His is not small, but small is where we all have to start. I'm not going to go on too much longer. I just ask that if anyone is listening for the first time, make sure you hit subscribe if you're listening in Stitcher or iTunes. Head on over and check us out so you can make sure you stay up to date on all of the forthcoming episodes. I'd really appreciate that. But without further ado, here is my interview with Jason Hartman. So Jason, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Aaron. I'm looking forward to sharing some good stuff, hopefully, and we can inspire your listeners today.
Absolutely. This is a show where we've had a lot of finance experts, a lot of people and very savvy in different aspects of the world of finance. And you are a man who wears a lot of different hats and a lot of different titles, an entrepreneur, an author, an investor, lender, developer. You host some podcasts. You have your own foundation. It's a little intimidating, quite frankly, if I'm reading off the list here, Jason. When you're maybe asked at a cocktail party, or you have to give a succinct explanation of what you do, how do you describe the work that you do?
That is a difficult one. You know, everybody says you should have an elevator speech, right? So you can explain to someone in 30 seconds. But I just mostly say I'm in real estate investing and publishing, which covers most of the gambit.
And real estate is really the major topic. You have a lot of different things that you talk about, but that is one of your real calling cards, and you've been a part of a ton of real estate transactions as you've built your business. Where did that initial interest in the world of real estate come from?
You know, I grew up in Los Angeles, California. I grew up without much money, much in the way of financial resources. And when I was 16 years old, looking, kind of thinking about an answer, I was, at the teenage years, I was kind of sensing, hey, this whole, financial thing, it's actually important. This is a really big part of life. And, I think some people minimize it, and I think that's really inappropriate that they do that. I think it is important. It's not everything, but it is something. And I saw an infomercial for a real estate guru. I went out and got his book, and I read about three chapters of it. I put it down, but my mom picked it up, Aaron, and she read the rest. And so I kind of forgot about it. 2 years later, I'm 18. I'm about to graduate from high school. And my mom says, Jason, you got me interested in this real estate investing stuff. There's a big seminar in Anaheim by Disneyland this weekend. Why don't you go? So I round up nine of my buddies from high school, and I get them all to go with me because I can't do anything alone when I'm that age. And so the first night, we're all there. By Saturday morning, only one of my friends remained. The rest went to the beach and soaked up the rays and had some fun. But I stayed there the whole weekend. And I really wanted to learn this stuff. And so I saw all of these different real estate gurus talking about how to be a real estate investor. And the next week, I decided I've got to just learn the basics. I didn't understand a lot of this stuff from the event. So I'm just going to get my real estate license, enroll in real estate school, and learn the trade, if you will. And so I did that. And in my first year of college, I was 19. I got my real estate license. I started selling real estate part-time while I was going to college. And about 6 months into my career, I was now 20, and one of my investors, a guy named Jim Wool, he had purchased a couple properties from me, and these were really crappy government repo properties, HUD and VA repo properties in Orange County and the Inland Empire in Southern California. And he said, you know, there's this one property you sold me, and I don't really like this one very much. It was a one-bedroom condo in Huntington Beach, California. And he said, why don't you take the listing and sell it for me, and I'll buy something else from you. And I said, you know what, Jim, I don't want to sell it for you. I want to buy it from you. And so I ended up buying my first property at age 20 from him, and it was a rental property. It wasn't to live in. I was still living at home with mom, and that was my start as a real estate investor. And since then, I've had I've had hundreds of tenants, hundreds of units, it's just been a great ride. I love income property. I think it's the most historically proven asset class in the entire world. It's really accessible. You know, almost anybody listening can become a real estate investor. And it's just a really proven conservative thing. You know, it works. We all know a lot of people who've become wealthy by investing in properties. So that's the beginning of the story. Yeah. Happy to answer any questions.
I hear you. What's really interesting about what you said is there's kind of this very apparent dichotomy between you and some of your peers, and that they're willing to go take the trip down there with you, but shortly, in a short amount of time, they were all at the beach having fun, relaxing, worried about other things. What, I don't know if I want to say made you different or made you stay when other people were leaving? Why do you think other, because you were only 18 years old, your peers were not interested in this type of stuff. Where did you find an interest at such a young age?
Well, you know, the old saying, you can either be motivated by inspiration or desperation. So I guess I had a little of both. Not growing up with money or resources, I wanted to have that in my life as an adult. And so that was the inspiration, desperation balance, I guess, between the two. That really motivated me. And I think a lot of my friends, they didn't have that. They didn't have the lack that I did. So they didn't have that real drive. You know, comfort and luxury is the lull to apathy, right? So you got to do something to motivate yourself. You know, either circumstances will motivate you, or you can do that internally by playing little tricks on yourself to motivate you. You know,
I'm very curious about that. You segued really nicely into my next question, where, you know, that was an initial circumstance for you, and as you're building, as you're getting started, you have the inspiration and the desperation. But as you find success and you've built these businesses and had, you know, things kind of come fully formed, how has your inspiration and your motivation changed as you've found more success building your real estate empire?
That's an interesting question, and to be very frank with you, I'm struggling with that a little bit. Now into my career, I'm way beyond the money thing. I mean, I guess I could be flying around on private jets more often and, you know, really blowing my money, but I don't know, that just doesn't seem very prudent to me. So I don't really do that kind of stuff too often. So it's really a long time ago, it stopped being about money, and it's sort of about the challenge and the fun of creating an idea or a service or a product and putting it out there in the marketplace and seeing it work. And then it's also about the mission of really helping people. I mean, I've always felt that I'm doing something I believe in. I believe deeply in it, and I want to share it with other people and expose them to it. And I get really nice letters several times a week, emails and things, and sometimes gifts from listeners to my podcast. People around the world send me things, and it's very inspiring to see that, you know, I'm like, wow, I'm really actually impacting and changing someone's life in a positive way at a pretty decent scale. I mean, not at the scale, say, Tony Robbins is doing it, but it really does matter to people, and that's very inspiring. That's why I get up and why I'm still working, you know?
Yeah. In terms of that work that you're doing to coach people, you've talked about real estate being this, you know, great asset that supersedes others. It's conservative, it's well tested, it's accessible. And in some of doing some research for this interview, I listened to a couple of your podcasts, some talks that you've done. And one of the kind of counterpoints to that is that you are not a big fan of stocks and bonds and other Wall Street type investments. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to be personally disenchanted with those type of investments and how real estate has kind of played a foil to those?
Well, you have done your homework, so I have to compliment you on that. I often say that Wall Street is the modern version of organized crime. And it's funny because I'll have a lot of these Wall Street people on my show as guests. And when I say that to them, they're not even offended, because they know it's true too. So that's kind of funny to me that everybody just seems to intuitively know that that's true. There's so much greed on Wall Street. It's literally mind-boggling. And you know, I've certainly personally invested in pooled assets like stocks, bonds, Wall Street assets, but also in partnerships and private placement memorandums, and those just usually don't go too well. And one of the things I say is, I call it commandment number 3 of my 10 commandments of successful investing, and that is thou shalt maintain control. Thou shalt maintain control. And 3 major problems occur when we relinquish our financial future, when we relinquish control of our money to somebody else. Number 1, we might be investing with a crook. Number 2, we might be investing with an idiot. And number 3, assuming they're honest and competent, if you pass those 2 hurdles, they take a huge management fee off the top for managing the deal. And that is why I think people should stay away from investments like that. They should be direct investors and invest in something that they own and control themselves, so that they don't have those 3 major risk factors of investing with a crook, an idiot, or someone who's just taking a big management fee off the top.
I hear you. Another thing that you've said you liked about real estate is its capacity for leverage. And this can be a term that to someone who is not a pro, not someone who's very savvy, can be confusing. It can have multiple connotations. In terms of an investment, or in terms of specifically a real estate investment, what does it mean to have leverage? And why is that significant?
So leverage is a very powerful concept. Many think the way the pyramids were built was through leverage. And leverage doesn't just apply to the financial world or the investing world. It also just applies to anything. You know, various motivational speakers and psychology people will talk about getting leverage over ourselves so we can make changes that we want to make. Leverage is important for anything. And income property, is income producing real estate, is the most leverage favored asset class. And what I mean by that is, if we all remember back to when we were a kid and maybe we were standing and the sun was setting behind us, and that cast a giant shadow in front of us, and we thought, wow, here I'm only 4 feet tall as a kid, but I look like I'm really tall in that shadow. And that's what leverage does. It magnifies our ability. It allows us to be more than we are. It allows us to do more than with less. And so on an income property investment, for example, if we put 20% down on that property, we can control 5 times as much real estate. So instead of going in and buying any traditional investment where we've got to essentially put 100% down, we have no leverage there. We can do 5 times more. We can accelerate our wealth creation 5 times faster with income property when we put 20% down and the bank puts the other 80% down on the deal. We get a 5-to-1 leverage ratio. So that's very powerful. If it would take you 5 years to achieve a certain return on investment with income property, you could do the same thing in 1 year potentially, because you've magnified your ability to create wealth with that leverage. Very, very powerful tool.
I hear you there. A lot of what you're saying there is that there's potential for people to be more leveraged. They're not necessarily taking advantage of the opportunity that's afforded to them when the bank is putting up 4/5 of the expense of a rental property. Can you talk at all about the opposite of that, of being over leveraged? So when someone, can you just maybe explain that terminology?
Sure.
And if you give advice for people about how to avoid being in that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So of my 10 commandments of successful investing, another one is thou shalt not gamble. And what that means is the property must make sense the day you buy it, or you just don't buy it. And making sense means from a cash flow perspective. Cash flow is what creates sustainability in the investing world. And if you don't have cash flow, if you're buying on speculation, if you're a gambler, if you're buying for appreciation, which may not come, in fact, the opposite may come, the property might depreciate in value, you are setting yourself up for disaster. So the property must make sense the day you buy it from a cash flow perspective. Cash flow is actually very reliable. Appreciation is not very reliable. In all my years in the business, I have never met anyone, including myself, who can reliably predict appreciation or depreciation cycles in the marketplace. Yet cash flow, on the other hand, is very reliable. It's not perfect by any means, but it's pretty darn reliable. If you buy a property for $100,000 and it rents for $1,000 per month, if the value of that property stays the same or it goes down or it goes up, you're probably going to still get your $1,000 a month out of that property. Or pretty close, one way or the other. It might be more, okay? So cash flow is actually very reliable, but appreciation is not very reliable at all. And that's a sucker's bet if you're investing for appreciation. It's the icing on the cake. It's great when it happens, but just don't depend on it. You should be investing in a way that you can earn a nice, healthy return on your investments, anywhere of a cash-on-cash return of maybe 10 to 14% annually without any appreciation. In fact, if the property goes down in value, you can still earn that same return on investment. And that's what makes it sustainable. You can hold on if you're earning that nice return. But if you're buying a property thinking it's going to double in value in the next 2 years, You're crazy. That's just, it may happen. And good, hey, if it does, I'd rather be lucky than good any day of the week. But you know, luck is not reliable, so I'll take just being prudent and conservative and investing for cash flow.
For sure, Jason. There's so much wisdom that's apparent through the stories you're telling and the information that you're sharing, and that's obviously bred through years and years, decades and decades in the industry. And one thing, you know, my dad always said when I was growing up was there's an easy way and a hard way to learn things. So obviously an easy way would be to take the advice that someone's hearing from an expert like you, go implement it. But in terms of your development of these commandments of rental property investing, I'm imagining that over the years there have been some times you had to learn things the hard way and take some bumps.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of having to deal with maybe making the decision to buy something for appreciation or something else that led to another one of your commandments. Can you tell me about a time where you had to learn a lesson like that the hard way?
Yeah, you know, I have not followed my commandments from time to time, and I've learned the hard way, definitely. You know, sometimes one of the things, that commandment number 3 is the big one, because investing in someone else's deal where you're not a direct investor, that just always seems to end in disappointment. Because I guess, unfortunately, it's just human nature. Someone always seems to have their hand in the cookie jar, as the old saying goes. And that may not even be illegal. It you know, they may legally do it. For example, I invested in a couple of restaurant bars recently, well, a couple of years ago. And, you know, they're just those investments are sort of unfolding now. And, you know, the guy that runs the deal is he's just, it's obvious, you know, they're paying themselves big salaries, the management people, you know, there's all sorts of free perks that they're giving out to customers and so forth, and expensing lots of things through the businesses. And it's just absurd, you know. If I was investing in my own deal, that would have never happened, because I can't steal from myself, okay? it's like cheating on your workout, right? Who are you really cheating, right? You're just cheating yourself.
Yeah.
If you don't do all 10 repetitions or whatever. And so it's the same thing. I mean, just be a direct investor. I've learned that lesson over and over. I'm sure I'll learn it again because, I do have some of my capital I dedicate toward risk capital. I try some things. And a lot of times I go into it even knowing I'm going to learn a lesson, which maybe I'm a glutton for punishment sometimes. I don't know.
But that is a great way to point out the different ways of learning. And if you're going into something saying, if this is something you're saying, like, I'm not okay, but I'll understand if I end up losing money here to learn a lesson. I think there's multiple opportunities to do that. I've heard of people investing in companies with a similar mindset. They know that a high percentage or majority of the companies they invest in are early stage startups that are going to fail, and they accept that, and they know going into it it's going to be a learning process. There's a chance for a payout, but they're really in it for the lesson. I'd imagine there's similar instances, be it a development project, be it a fixer-upper or something like that, that you've gone into and had to put those lessons together as
you know, it doesn't really happen too often with the properties because they're so stable and proven. I mean, though they work. Of course, you can make mistakes in real estate, no question. But if you're not investing in the high land value markets, you know, there are three basic types of real estate markets. There's a linear market, a cyclical market, and a hybrid of the two. And the linear cash flow oriented markets, it's pretty hard to make any big mistake in those markets. And you've heard the old saying, time heals all wounds. And the wonderful, resilient thing about income property investing is that if you can just sustain the investment for a time, you'll usually come out a winner. Real estate is a game of staying power. And as long as you're investing for cash flow and not appreciation, you automatically, by virtue of that structure, you have staying power.
Just to help me clarify a little bit more about what you mean by the hybrid, cyclical, and linear types of housing markets, I don't know if this is what you're referencing, but I know that I live in Pittsburgh. That's a very stable housing market. We don't see much fluctuation.
That's a linear market, yeah.
Okay. And so what you're saying there is that it's just gradually increasing
right.
consistently
but,
over time.
But right next to you, you have Washington, D.C., you have New York City, you have Boston. Those are all very cyclical markets where they have glorious highs and really ugly troughs where things get really bad. And so they go up and down. And those markets have, I created something I call the Hartman Risk Evaluator. And I'll try to just quickly explain this to your listeners. But basically, it took me 19 years to discover this. And I discovered, after being a Southern California investor for many years, and that, of course, is a cyclical market where it has glorious highs and really ugly falls, okay? And in that market, what I discovered is that if you invest in markets with high land value and markets that are very newsworthy, that are getting a lot of attention from the media, those are the markets really you want to avoid. Those are the speculators' markets. Those are the gamblers' markets. And you'll hear the stories, and your greed instinct might kick in because you'll hear the stories of people making fortunes in a very short time. But the reality is, you don't hear as many stories about people losing their shirt in a very short time, too, in those markets. And they never make sense from a cash flow perspective. So high land value markets are risky, cyclical markets. No matter where you are on planet Earth, you could be talking about Moscow, you could be talking about Paris, London, any high-end place, Singapore, Dubai. I just got back from Dubai. Anywhere like that around the world, you're going to have a very speculative mindset. Nothing will ever make sense from a cash flow perspective. The rent-to-value ratios in those markets will generally be about a 0.3 or a 0.4, meaning that if you buy a $1 million property, it'll rent for $3,000 to $4,000 per month. You can do that in euros or pounds sterling, too. It's the same equation, no matter where you are around the world, no matter what currency you're dealing in. But in the linear markets, the markets we recommend, those are markets like Memphis, Atlanta, Indianapolis, and a host of others that are all on my website at jasonhartman.com. In those markets, you can get 1% per month. So $1 million will buy you 10 single-family homes that will rent for $1,000 each. You get $10,000 from your $1 million investment versus $3,000 or $4,000. And that's what will sustain you through a cycle, is that good, solid, cash flow-oriented investment.
For sure. Jason, there's been a ton of wisdom packed into this conversation. I want to start wrapping things up. Before we tell people how to connect with you and you issue a challenge to the audience, I just want to make sure, is there anything I didn't give you a chance to say?
No, you know, I mean, I think that covers it. I guess I would just say that one of the other inspirations for me to get into real estate, and this would be a good thing for your listeners to think about, is that when I was in high school, my mother had a couple of small businesses, and she was working at her full-time day job on the side, and eventually she was very prudent about saving money, saved up money, bought a couple of businesses, and I managed them. And I just remember one of them was a Pioneer Chicken franchise, kind of like KFC, but an inferior version of it. and I remember thinking that every time you sell someone some food, you've got to do a certain amount of work, and maybe the net to the business is a dollar or two, okay? Versus in real estate, because you're dealing with a high-ticket item, every time you do a job for someone, you get a small percentage of that high-ticket item, so it's much more powerful. So, you know, there are really two ways to make money in the world, basically, right? You either have a product that has mass appeal, you can scale it, systematize it, and deliver it easily without much friction to your customers, or you have a higher-priced product that probably doesn't scale as well, and doesn't deliver as easily, but at least you'll earn a larger fee from that transaction. And so those two things I think I would really impart to your listeners. And mine is the high-ticket route, the real estate route. But, you know, you can certainly do it either way. But if you're doing it on the low-end way, it's got to be systematized, scalable, and with as little friction as possible.
For sure. Great advice. Very actionable takeaways, I think, for listeners. If they want to learn more about you, get some more of the great advice that you're offering, Jason, where's the best place for them to find you in the digital world?
Two places. My real estate website is jasonhartman.com. That's just my name, jasonhartman.com. And then also for my podcast network, that's hartmanmedia.com. And we've got a variety of podcasts on investing, personal finance, economics. Longevity is a hot new show we're doing. Longevity and biohacking, travel, whole host of things. So those are all at Hartman Media. And then the real estate stuff's at jasonhartman.com.
Fantastic. As always, that will be linked to in our show notes at goingdeepwithaaron.com/podcast. Thank you so much, Jason, for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate it. But I'm going to give you the mic one last time to take it away with your personal challenge for the audience.
You know, that's a cool challenge that you have this challenge, Aaron. and it's making me think. But I'll tell you something. One of the things I did about 12 years ago is I set up a charitable foundation. And one of the things you are required by the IRS to do, now you can donate a bunch of money to your own foundation, and I don't take donations from anybody else, it's just my own money, that's it, okay? And so every year, pretty much, I put money into my foundation. But the rule is that you have to give away a certain percentage of it every year. And so it forces you to give away. And one of the things I learned many years ago from Jim Rohn and then later Tony Robbins, who also learned from Jim Rohn, a great business philosopher, is that if you give things away, you are sending a message to your subconscious mind that the world is abundant and there's more. And just this wonderful thing happened to me. It still touches me. And I don't know where it came from. It's a very minor thing. It's a very small, random act of kindness. But I walked into Starbucks in the morning to get my usual tall blonde. and coffee, that is. But I keep affirming that to the world because I'd like a tall blonde girlfriend. But anyway, so I order my tall blonde and a yogurt, and the clerk at Starbucks says it's free. You know, I have my credit card out ready to pay, and she says it's free. And I said, well, why is it free? And she says, well, someone came in and bought a gift card and just left it with us and paid it forward today for a bunch of people. So, you know, until their gift card runs out, everything's free. And I thought, wow, what a cool thing. And you know, I really wanted to know who it was to say thanks. But here they just did that, this random act, and bought coffee for a bunch of strangers. They had no idea who would be in line after them, right? And I just thought that was super cool. And it sets up our minds to know that there's more. So give something away without expectation of getting anything back, or even letting someone know who was the giver or having any way for them to know you. I thought that was real cool. So there's my challenge. That one, and then I'll add one more to it. Be really curious. Being curious has been a huge part of my success, I believe. And I think it's very important for everybody, is just to be incredibly curious all the time and be a constant learner. So two challenges.
For sure. That the curiosity is what this show is all about. I love picking the brain of smart guys like you, Jason. And the giving something away can be very, very fun. I encourage everyone to do that. I'll be doing that this week for sure. We just went deep with Jason Hartman. I hope everyone out there has a fantastic day. Hey everyone, hope you enjoyed that episode. Jason is full of wisdom. I learned a ton from talking with him, and I hope you did the same. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure that you subscribe, leave a 5-star rating and review on Stitcher or iTunes so we can continue to put out great episodes like this one. If you're looking for more personal finance money advice, I would encourage you to check out episode 55 with Morgan Housel. Morgan is a personal finance writer for The Motley Fool and had a ton of wisdom to share when he came on. If you also have already heard that one or are looking for another one, be sure to check out our episode with Ben Carlson of A Wealth of Common Sense. That's episode 59, I believe. But those are both two great jam-packed episodes, full of wisdom, full of insight. And I hope you'll continue to listen to this show. We've got a ton of great episodes coming down the pipe that I'm excited to share with you. And I'm really just thankful for your attention and for listening. Take care.